Many thanks going out to Sparkle Motion for taking us through the end of another Thursday morning. We have now tipped over into a Thursday afternoon. Once again, here on 90.7 FM, KALX Berkeley, university and listener-sponsored radio, and it is indeed time, as announced, for the program Arts and Review. My name is Gregor Sharpen. I'm going to be your host for the next half hour, talking today about cartography, in a way. We have with us in the studio today Eric Pleise, who is has a whole host of shows coming up in the next month-ish or so. I didn't realize it had been quite a while since you'd done the shows in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I've been touring and kind of laying low, and I don't want to, you know, you don't want to overdo it. So, sparingly is good.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us
today. Oh, thank you for having me.
I guess maybe just to kind of set the stage, we should talk about, when I say cartography, what the hell do I mean? What are the projects that you do?
Yeah, I do what I call performance cartography, which involves using OpenStreetMap data and a variety of open source mapping libraries to basically project maps and manipulate them in real time. So I'm changing color, I'm changing location, I'm playing with the labeling and using non-traditional fonts. And I'm usually working with musicians or some other time-based artists. So I've worked with dancers also, but mostly musicians.
Although not always. There have been at least a couple of instances I know where it's been just you. The top of the tower is one of the ones that I...
That's true. Yeah, I kind of consider that a different practice. Yes. I mean, generally I do maps, you know, and the tools that I've built for the performance work helps me prototype other projects like fixed videos, you know, like single channel or multi-channel work. So, yeah, one of the great satisfactions of this work was having a piece up on top of the Salesforce Tower a couple years ago now.
Yeah.
It's funny because I applied to that program a couple times and always got rejected. And then one morning I got an email kind of out of the blue, like, you still interested in doing this? And I live up on Twin Peaks, so I open my front door and that building confronts
me. There it is.
And it's like, I hate you. And then for a month I loved it. So, it was great. Very satisfying.
I guess maybe we just before we get into some of the specifics of the performances of the pieces that are going to be coming up, just kind of to dig into a little to like why cartography, what it is. I mean, how did you arrive at this practice, and what is it about maps that is sort of like brings you to this? I mean, I know for myself, I have my own kind of personal relationship with maps and kind of the textural quality that maps have, but I'm kind of wondering how you're approaching it.
Yeah. Well, I believe that when I was a little kid, I took one of those aptitude standardized tests, and one of the things they thought I would be good at was cartography. And I didn't go down that path, but I remember, like, it's too weird to make that up. So I think it's true. So maps of all, I did a PhD in engineering, and that dealt with sort of spatial markets. So there was a locational aspect to that. But it wasn't really until the early 2000s, mid-2000s, I was team teaching a class at CCA with my sculptor girlfriend at the time on mapping. So I had to really, she was going to be the 3D sculptural, science fiction is mapping, like all these kind of out there things. And I was like, this is how you do a survey. With a chain, and you triangulate on that building over there. So I was a very rational.
So you figure out the elevation. And the...
So I was kind of the rational, engineer guy. But I also, at that time I learned a lot about the history of cartography. And, at the end of the class, it was like, I can't throw this away. Like, this was too much work. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing web development since the very beginning of the web. So I really tried to only take jobs that involve mapping after that.
Mm.
So that's when I really got into the technology, and it grew a lot during those years. Simultaneously, I've always been interested in experimental film and other practices. And for a while, it was like, I don't do computers in my art. I do computers by my day job. But a lot of the art, 16-millimeter filmmaking is expensive and not very forgiving, and copper plate photogravure is worse. So at one point, it was like, I could make things that are like experimental films using map technology. And things really took off, like for me personally, as an artist, took off after that.
Well, as you say, you're doing live manipulations, which you can't do on 16-millimeter. Well, I'll walk that back. You can do live
performance.
You can do a lot of things in 16-millimeter productions, but to the degree that you can on like certain video programs where you can like really get into the nitty gritty of the manipulations of the media and of the image. Computers certainly give you several legs up over being able to just like, well, I can have at least a couple of projectors going and maybe manipulate some loops, but you know, you're more limited in celluloid than are in on computers. Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, one of the things that when you were talking about maps, I mean, I think there's so many different layers that you could have to them. There's the historical context of maps. I mean, you can go all the way from Here There Be Dragons to Google Maps. You have this whole range of kind of modes of mapping and degrees of definition of mapping or, you know, accuracy of mapping.
Yeah, and what you leave in and what you put, you know, take out, because that's really the whole politics behind maps, you know, or use, you know, usability of maps. Like if you're designing a map for the campus, there's certain things you don't need to have on there and certain things you definitely do.
Or, you know, what's a political map versus what an actual terrain map, you know, like a political border is different from what a river is.
Yes.
So, you know, there's all these kinds of interesting sort of almost philosophical underpinnings to what a map presents.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really one of the things I kind of get for free with this work. You know, like people ask if I have a narrative or, you know, what's the secret, like what happened just now? Like what was the rationale behind those locations? And I don't, you know, I mean, for me, a lot of it is just visual. I like to use this word cartogenic. Like I have a lot of things that look pretty good, you know, street grids that are very orderly, but then there are these very organic coastlines or river deltas, you know, things that are visually interesting. And because people have so many different relationships with maps and geography, you know, they bring their own stuff to it. So even if I had, I mean, this is true with any art, right? Like you have something you want to say, but people will do their own thing.
Right.
But with maps, that's more general. And, you know, like to talk to people after a performance and to hear what they got out of it is really something. And I don't need to, like, I'm just going to leave that alone.
Right.
I will say, you know, the maps that I do are, you know, they are technically vector maps. Mm-hmm. So they do, I mean, they look Google Map-ish, but the colors are very different. You
right.
know, I don't do much with, I mean, it's funny, one of my paying gigs is with the Open Historical Map Project. So I am interested in historical maps, and there have been people, either curators or collaborators, that are like, well, can you pull in a historical map like Chicago before the fire or something? I haven't done that yet, but, you know, it's one of those things that, like, if I get a 1 or 2 month residency somewhere, I may look into that.
Those are less easily manipulable than a vector map.
It's different, and it's not.
And the texture is different. It's not. I mean, the degree of abstraction is different as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things that about your work that is interesting to me is that is there's certain points where it gets very abstract, and then you can pull out. It's like, oh, now I see where I am, rather than these planes that are just interacting with each other.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Historical maps really nail things down.
Yeah.
In a concrete way.
I'm involved in a project that deals with travel right now, and there was a portion of it which was about Italy, and there was a discussion about the idea of like the town squares in Italy and sort of the way that the streets work in Italy. And one of the people who was in the conversation was referring to the fact that, you know, streets in Europe or sort of maps and cities in Europe, you have a town square and then there's like this spaghetti blah, of streets that go away from that, and compared to like American cities where you have these straight grids, like New York City, you know, Manhattan is just all 90-degree angles versus, say, like Naples or something like that, or Venice, where you have this, like, the lines are different and the just kind of the image of the map is different. And I think, I mean, part of what you do as well, I think, kind of speaks to different locations and kind of the different sort of rigidity of structure of the places.
Absolutely. Yeah, although it's interesting that you contrast it with Europe, because there are these planned fortified cities that are like hexagonal cities or, you know, very, very regular. You know, they're not grids like Manhattan, but they still have these geometric shapes that are really quite perfect and look beautiful on the screen. So, yeah, part of the performance goes, you know, visits those and makes people wonder where was that? Because it's all real. You know, like none of this stuff is made up.
Right.
It all comes from data, you know, the crowdsourced data. Sometimes there's errors in it, which is fun, but
you got to lean into that a little bit.
Absolutely.
Perhaps.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's talk the specifics. You were talking about a piece that you had done in, was it Austin or Dallas?
Yeah. Or? You know, you mentioned Salesforce. That was the first, like, sort of commission that I had. And there's a group in Austin called Data Geek that has a space called Data Lab. And they have a new program called CAST, which is Contemporary Art and Sound Technologies. And they basically, you know, had people apply. They picked six visual artists and six composers, paired them, And then we worked on a piece over a few months and premiered it in Austin in the end of March. We had a week to workshop it. We worked with, our piece was performed by Line Upon Line Percussion, who actually was just here recently. Hmm. They did a show at SynMat.
Oh, okay.
They do a lot of work with like PhD composition students. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, they must be friends with Ken Wayno.
So oh, okay.
He brought them in.
Ken Wayno, who's at UC Berkeley.
Yes.
Yeah, professor of.
Yes.
Music, I guess that would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Please give context when I forget to. yeah. So that was great. Yeah. So we workshopped it for a week and, you know, I made, you know, that was a fixed video. I did not improvise that piece, but there were, you know, being in the space, which was pretty, I mean, it's a sort of an industrial warehouse off campus. It's not a campus project, although many of them have connections to UT Austin. But basically it was essentially four screens wide. So there was two screens on the back wall and two screens on the side walls. And, you know, so I had this enormous canvas to work with.
Abel Gance's Napoleon, as if it was cartography.
yeah, kind of. And you mentioned Manhattan. Manhattan looks really good spread across that. Also, there's this famous highway interchange in L.A. that also looks really good spread that wide. So I did that show. And I mentioned that because, it's a 15-minute piece with composer Shahrzad Talebi. And that will be part of the show here at West Oakland Sound Series on June 28th. And here the performance will be with Suki O'Kane, who I think a lot of people know, percussionist, experimental, wonderful person, and a guy named Graham Vigets, who I haven't met yet. Yeah, he's kind of new in town.
Yeah, I don't know him.
I mean... A lot of my practice is touring, and a lot of my practice is working with people I've never worked with before. So a little bit that happens on the home front, too. He's kind of new in town. He has Texas connections also. And he did do a show at Center for New Music, so he's, like, finding his way here.
Is he also a percussionist? Or?
Yes, okay. Yes, they're both percussionists. Yeah, the piece is for two percussionists and pre-recorded electronic sound and maps.
I mean, I love the fact that Suki is basically ostensibly a percussionist, although quite frequently she's doing completely non-percussive things, and she frequently brings, for people who don't know Suki O'Kane, she's probably best known in this as sort of a puckish prankster where she brings the biggest bass drum she can possibly bring and tries to make the quietest possible sounds off of that bass drum just to prank you.
Yeah, this piece has a graphic score and fixed instrumentation. So actually we were talking last night, okay, who knows where we can get a water phone? And we found one.
I've seen Suki play a water phone with the Inkboat show recently, I think
I mean, she. If we're straight with that. There's this other piece called a Waldteufel.
Waldteufel?
Yeah. Do you know it?
German Waldteufel is the forest devil.
Okay. That's what somebody said. I mean, apparently in here it's called a frog buzzer.
Oh.
Which I learned yesterday. Okay. But it's basically a metal. It's a piece of metal that's attached to a small kind of drum head, and you turn it, and it makes this like quiet clacking sound. If you go fast, it does sound like a ribbit.
Yes.
So
okay.
That we might still be trying to track
down. Waldteufel. I wonder. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. So they'll have a table of small percussion that they share and a couple cymbals and some other things at that show on the 28th. Yeah.
And that's going to be at Drescher Studios, which has a very nice big. That has the potential of a very nice big screen that they can unfurl the curtains from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am going to remix the piece because doing things four screens wide only works
if you
in
have
one
four screens.
Place.
Yes.
So I'm going to mix it for a standard aspect ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Same material, but it'll be kind of a different performance. But it's the West Coast premiere.
So for something like that, would you be? I mean, are you sort of like cropping to select certain aspects of it, or I mean, how does that condensation work to get it down?
That's a great question because I haven't done it yet. One of the things that the folks in Austin liked was that I didn't think in terms of there being four screens. So I chopped the full thing into threes and fifths and eighths. Like some of them rounded off, but a lot of them, you know, wrapped around the corner. And so I have to figure out how to map that into a single screen. I think, you know, things that were in fours may be like two across and two down.
So I can make it a grid, a matrix of something.
Yeah. I mean, the image I'm thinking of there actually had kind of a pop art look. So it might sort of look like a Warhol thing when that's happening. Other things I might do thin slices of or do some reworking, but I don't really want to stray too far from the original footage. And I also have to remix it because Shahrzad's going to show it at University of North Texas on a five screen wide thing. So there's another mix.
So you need to add another panel. So you can have the four screens, and then you can add the single channel that you're doing here. So that's the dresser could be the fifth channel.
That sounds like a shortcut, but I don't know how aesthetically if that's going to be as pleasing. But anyway, also on that, while we're talking about that show and UC Berkeley, actually, I Ken also has this performance series that happens at Woo Hall, I think it's called, or the Woo Space, on Fridays often. And I went to a program of American music played by a young pianist named Christopher Harto. Mm-hmm. And it was brilliant. He did an Adams piece, he did a Zhevsky piece, he did some Gershwin, and he did an Ives piece.
Oh, so he's like sort of across a range of years.
Of American music, And I was just blown away by his playing. So he will be the second piece. So I'm gonna open with a solo piece. I'll do something with Christopher that we're still figuring out, and then there'll be the 15-minute piece. So it's a half hour set. Maybe it'll go a little bit over.
And do you remember who else is? I mean, is it just because it's your set? Sets plural. And then who else is on the bill? Do you remember?
Yes, I do. I remember some of them are locals that I've worked with. So Tom Bickley, Jamie Robles, and Nancy Beckman are the second act. And then there's somebody who's on tour from Seattle who's performing, and I can look up the name, but it's escaping me because I don't know this person.
I mean, that's one of the things I like about the way Matt Ingles produces the SF Sound series, is that frequently it'll be people who it's either on occasion it'll be people who like perfectly go together, but on more occasions it's like I'm going to try to put together two very disparate but still linked things, but try to keep them as disparate as possible, to bring people from multiple audiences to sort of show the range of experimental music and performance in the Bay Area. And so I like the fact that he's frequently putting people together with people who you don't know, and it's kind of there's a sense of like discovering, oh wait, there's other things out there that I, you know, as knowledgeable as I am about the area, I don't know this person. So there's something really kind of enlivening about the way that curation works.
Yeah, he's an excellent curator. Yeah. I mean, he's an excellent musician also. Like his clarinet playing and his electronics are fantastic. We collaborated on a piece there last year, and everybody was kind of blown away because like they're used to him introducing the shows or playing in the large ensemble, but not really doing so much solo work or duo work. And he just knocked it out of the park. It was great.
So, I mean, collaboration is something that I actually wanted to talk about because, I mean, mostly, as you said, and as my experience of you has been, that it's pretty frequently in collaboration. I wonder if we could maybe sort of explore that as a notion because, as you say, you're sometimes collaborating with people who you may or may not have met and, you know, in cities and towns and states that you have not been to before. So, kind of explore that a little bit and kind of that as an aesthetic choice of like I'm going to put myself into a completely unknown area and make something in unknown circumstances. which is definitely a choice that not everybody makes.
You know, I mean, this is the sort of thing I should have been doing in my 20s and 30s and not at my increasingly advanced age, but it's a lot of fun. I feel like I'm making up for lost time, both in the practice in general, but also in this touring stuff. One of the things that's been fun is that I because it's technical, I mean, the software I use, like I'm using some open source libraries, but there's a bunch of stuff I've written because, you know, music software is not supposed to talk to maps.
Right.
So I need to glue all those things together. So I can speak about the work technically to an engineering audience. I can speak about the mapping to a cartography audience. So I'll often go to one of those and give a presentation and then perform either as part of the conference program or I'll have an adjacent show in some local microcinema or gallery.
Like, I've been invited to a conference in Portland, Maine. Who's some musicians in Portland that I can
Yeah, I mean, you know, all you musicians out there, tag your location on Bandcamp. And don't tag it experimental if it's not. You know what I mean? Yeah, I spend a lot of time on Bandcamp. I mean, increasingly, you know, now that I've done 50 of these shows, so I actually have a pretty good network of musicians, and I can fall back on that. Like, who do you know in town X? Uh-huh. But the discovery is fun if I can get to someone. So it's usually like, find a venue, find a date, find a musician or ensemble.
Right.
And yeah, it's super interesting because some people, you know, like I worked with Chris Bobrowski here, and she was like, "We're going to do this, Cage Cunningham. Like, I'm not going to look at the screen, and you shouldn't listen to me, and we're just going to do this, and the audience will put it together in their head." And then I've worked, you know, the late Jim Ryan in D.C. He's like, you know, whatever you put up there, man, that's our score. That's what we're doing.
Using that as a graphic score.
Yeah. And this guy, Chino Ortega in Guadalajara, upright bass player, he was like, man, that was like doing a Braxton piece. It's like, what a compliment, you know, like, what better could you hope for? But you know, he saw it the same way, you know, like there are these images that are stimulating something. And, you know, I mean, I prefer, and most of the shows are give and take, you know, like I hear what the musicians are doing and I might choose a location or a palette that kind of goes
or
with what they're doing.
Or move over the map or like, yeah.
There is a lot of motion, either, you know, abrupt motion or sort of a smooth flight, and I can control the speed of those things. So, you know, a lot of it is, and even, you know, in the thing with Chris, I did listen to her because her invented instruments are so beautiful.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to not listen to that.
how can I not listen? So I will change things up if I want them to do something different. We will often have some cues, you know, if it starts to look like this is where I'm headed, and this definitely means we're ending. Because, you know, you get excited, you get nervous, and it's like, oh yeah, we never talked about how we're going to end. So there are ways to do that. But yeah, I mean, I like working with new instrumentation. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'd never worked with a French horn person before, and I had that opportunity in D.C. with this guy, Abe Mamet, and yeah, I mean, I love working. It's interesting. So I'm working like on the. There's a program this Saturday at Beauty Supply.
Yep.
And Fred Lomberg Holm, cellist, is on that program, and that's kind of a cello is sort of my favorite instrument. And actually, the first performance I gave as part of a residency in Lisbon was with a cellist named Helena Espfall.
Oh yes, of course.
And you know. I mean, it was a beautiful performance, and I mean, also
as far as cellists go, that kind of sets the bar very high for any future cellist you would be working with.
Yeah. No, I've been really lucky with it. You know, like almost nobody says no, and if they say no, it's either because the finances aren't right or they're
just scheduling
touring
or something. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the venues have been pretty great, and musicians have really been quite open to this weird thing that I do. Especially at the beginning when I didn't even have any performance footage to show them. Like, they were just kind of going into it blind.
Like, I guess he knows what he's doing, maybe.
Right. I mean, often we'll, you know, especially if I'm touring, there's very little chance to rehearse other than the sound check.
Mm-hmm.
We'll often talk in advance on Zoom or email or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's so many different ways. People's like, okay, was I talking to them on WhatsApp or was it Instagram?
Right,
you know, like, how do I even find where that conversation was?
Where's the email? Oh, it's not on email. That's right.
People don't do email. I mean, some people do, but some people don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'm really answering your question about collaboration.
I guess sort of a follow-on question of that is that in terms of like sort of figuring out the parameters for your part of the performance, like do you – if you're approaching somebody, you say, well, I have this city for footage, so it's going to be this city that we're dealing with or this part of the continent. Or is it like I'm dealing with this person? And after conversation, it's like, oh, France. Okay, Nevers. We'll do a Nevers map or something like that.
It's not usually that specific.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really, it is things that can be anywhere that just look right, you know? So if the music's doing a certain thing, it suggests something and I bring that up. And it may, you know, I may keep the same location up and really work with the colors. Again, the color... Mm-hmm. I mean, the greatest compliment I get, apart from the Braxton thing, was that I'm a good colorist. You know, and a lot of it is, you know, you've got roads and you've got land, and if you bring those colors very close together, they kind of disappear, and maybe the roads will come forward or the roads will go backward. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very Hans Hoffmann, very painterly kind of approach. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's very strident and very psychedelic and very jarring, like a Paul Sheritz kind of film, you know, which is like he did a lot of color flicker films. For people who don't know. But sometimes it's very subtle and very slow, and it just really depends on the instrumentation and what the musician's doing and if I want to compliment that or if I want to oppose it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's the basis of improvisation.
Yeah.
I mean, leaving aside the don't listen to the music and I won't look at the screen kind of thing, I mean, the whole point of that is like you enter into performance. I mean, improvisers do this all the time. They'll musical improvisers, they'll show up in a town and go, oh, you and you, oh, the four of us are going to be doing a show. We've never played with each other before. We don't know what each other do, but it's just you sit and you listen and you see, now I can do this and now I can do this. So it's more, it is really a, a, a large feedback loop.
Yeah, and a thing that will make the Beauty Supply show very different from West Oakland is that, you know, Fred's on the program, and there's a quintet of other local, you know, Nathan Corder and I don't know all these people. Lauren Benedict, David Golightly, and Tasia Abbott. I haven't worked with them before. They're going to perform as a quintet, and then we'll close by me doing kind of what you said, which I did in at a show in Denver and also in Tucson, which is like, okay, my project is called A Synesthete's Atlas. So I actually will display a title from an actual atlas to sort of be a clue as to what you might see or what the musicians might do. And then it's like, I want you and you. And we'll do like a 5 or 8 minute piece. And then it's like, okay, you go away. And then you three people come up. And then we'll end with the full ensemble. But that's been a fun way to work. And it's, you know, I had the synesthesia thing kind of locked down, but the atlas part, I haven't really played up as much. Uh-huh. But this last tour made me think more in terms of, yeah, titling movements, you know, kind of as, you know, an improvisation game.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes. To give some clues. I mean, yeah. So the Beauty Supply show will be like that.
I knew this was going to happen, that we were going to run out of time. We always run out of time. But we should mention the specifics once again, kind of running down the performances that we've been talking about. So Eric Theiser, who has a series of shows running through at least mid-July, there is the Beauty Supply show on Saturday the 13th,
yep.
Which is in, I guess that's technically Uptown Oakland?
You know, it's spitting distance from Tribune Tower.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think of it as downtown, but I live in the city. So even being a map guy, yeah. My geography of neighborhoods may not be perfect. Uh-huh. It's like Pill Hill. What is that?
What is that? Is it just the Kaiser Building, or is it just
anyway, it's very close to 12th Street Park.
Yeah. Yes. And then.
And people can contact me for the address because they don't share the address.
They try not to, yes.
Super publicly.
It's part of the Ask a Punk kind of aesthetic,
right.
Which that's an entire other conversation. Yeah. I actually had that conversation with lots of people about city governments and support of art spaces and lack of support for art spaces. But that is a rant that will have to happen on another show.
Fight the good fight.
Right. also, there's the Garden of Memory that you're going to be part of.
Yeah, I'm alternating space with Agnes Selig in the Cloister of Cherubs. This show's already sold out, so I can't really...
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry, but it's.
You're swapping back and forth with Agnes rather than.
Yeah, we haven't figured out if we're doing. Yeah, we're not performing together, so I think we'll do like 1 hour shifts.
Another fantastic cellist, although I don't know if she'll be doing cello work at this.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
I know she sort of only occasionally will bring out her cello, but she is a remarkable, remarkable cellist.
That's good to know for future.
Yes, someone to sort of like tap and go, by the way.
Gregory says.
And then on the 28th, Sunday the 28th, part of the West Oakland Sound series that FSO Sound and Matt Ingalls has put together. And those are at Drescher Studios on Poplar and Grand?
West Grand,
I want to say. Those generally start at 7 o'clock, I think.
You know, Matt's like, we start at 7:15.
Yeah.
And they do.
But if you think 7 o'clock,
yeah,
you'll arrive there by 7:10 in time to be there for the show. And then there's something at the Center for New Music in the Tenderloin on July 9th.
Yeah, that'll be a solo show. That's kind of far off, so I haven't really nailed that up.
Solo show as in no other musician with you, or is it?
No, I'll be doing my own sound.
Really?
I'll be doing my own sound for Chapel of Chimes too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then there's the possibility of a show in Petaluma around that same time. Mid-July, but it's still being discussed.
Well, for people who want to find out, there is a website for people.
There is a website, ericktheise.com, ericktheise. I'm on Instagram too, same name. I'm not hard to find, really. My name's odd enough or unique enough that I'm not hard to find. Although there is a marijuana seller in Southern California with the same name.
So I bet you get some occasionally very peculiar requests.
Very occasionally, but it has happened. Well, yeah, somebody congratulated me on my new business, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I mean, yeah, that's far from my drug of choice anyway, so. Well, I guess you don't want to do your own, dip into your own stash. So.
Well, on the topic of finding new musicians and someone that you actually introduced me to, I have an asthmatic track.
Oh, great.
Queued up. Who is somebody who is she in Portland or is it?
Yeah, Portland, I mean, Portland, Maine.
Portland, Maine.
The other Portland.
The other Portland. And I think the asthmatic was someone that you just encountered kind of happenstance, right? That was one of the people who's like, I don't know who you are, but you're on Bandcamp.
I found her on Bandcamp, yeah. And, you know, her. I mean, she's very influenced by like the Amanda Golas and these very experimental kind of harsh noise vocalists. I mean, there were points in our, we had two performances and I was terrified a couple times. yeah, she's great.
Although she can also do some very, you know, very beautiful and very lulling. And
well, that's
very,
that's what led me to her. Yeah. There was one, I don't remember the name of the recording, but there was one that had quite a variety of style. It's this is the person. She's young. She plays out a lot. There's a place called the Aphadian or Apohadian Theater. Philip Greenleaf plays there now because he's living
he's
a Mainer too. Yeah. So, great. Play.
Yeah. And I'm since I bought stuff from her on Bandcamp, I keep on getting messages from her saying, I'm playing. I was like, yes, but you're playing on the wrong coast.
Yeah.
You need to come out here.
She's very active. She plays a lot.
Yeah, she plays a lot. And I wish she would actually come out to the West Coast one of these days because I would love to see her perform live.
But I will clue her into this recording and let her know. I would like to collaborate with her again.
Eric Thaiza, thank you so much for coming to
talk
with us today.
Yeah.
This has been the Program Arts and Review here on 90.7 FM, KALX Berkeley. Velvet Einstein is coming up momentarily to take you up until 3 o'clock. And there will be another interview with Vicky Fong, I believe, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you will not want to go anywhere else. We'll be back next week. Everybody out there, take care. Have a good Thursday.
And I'd save them by ringing them over the sink. Carried on to more intense situations. Oh, walking for 2 hours straight in one direction. Forcing myself to get a little more angry at work than ringing the X's. Ringing bands around my fingers and co-workers out with my purple hair. And quasi repeat for more than a day or two. Oh, when I'm asked about the lead, I'm right. I hide it and say there's not much to do. And it's believed. It's believed.
Son, an avid reader, patron buyer of the lot. But only in what I first asked about. Oh, my interest will never spread a great length. Just further down the roots of what's mentioned that. When you're deemed serious and honestly. Very, very sick. We'll be right back.